Do you know the one about what happens when you cross a Unitarian and a Jehovah's Witness? They knock on your door, but don't have anything in particular to say. Or how about this one? How many Unitarians does it take to change a light bulb? Answer. We choose not to make a statement either in favor of or against the need for a light bulb. However, if in your own journey you have found that light bulbs work for you, that is wonderful. You are invited to write a poem or compose a modern dance about your own personal relationship with your light bulb. Present it next month at our annual Light Bulb Sunday service, in which we'll explore a number of light bulb traditions, including incandescent, fluorescent, three-way, long life, and tinted, all of which are equally valid paths on the way to luminescence. Years ago, the humorist John Carroll, who was writing for the San Francisco paper, published what he said was a communique from a group calling itself Unitarian Jihad. The whole thing is fabulous. You can look it up. It's still online. Read the whole thing. It begins with this paragraph. Greetings to the imprisoned citizens of the United States. We are Unitarian Jihad. There is only one God, unless there is more than one God. The vote of our God subcommittee is 10-8 in favor of one God with two abstentions. Brother Flaming Sword of Moderation noted the possibility of there being no God at all, and his objection was noted with love by the secretary. It goes on. It's great. It concludes, people of the United States, we are Unitarian Jihad. We can strike without warning. Pockets of reasonableness and harmony will appear as if from nowhere. Nice people will run the government again. There will be coffee and cookies in the Gandhi room after the revolution. And we probably, I don't know, Unitarian Jihad is a little, it edges up to Islamophobia and stereotypes. I don't know about that, but it's funny nonetheless, and you can read it. If you type in Unitarian Jihad name generator, it will give you your own Unitarian Jihad name. So I did it while I was writing this on Friday, and it gave me Father Battle Axe of Moderation. I'll take it. That's pretty good. Coming. Yeah. It's good to laugh at ourselves. It's good. It's really important. Don't take yourself too seriously. It should be rule one of religion. It's good for us to laugh at ourselves. It doesn't feel so good when other people laugh at us, though, does it? And it doesn't feel good at all. And they do. Laugh or attack. We were in the news late last year, as you know, as we are from time to time. And when we are in the news for any reason, especially something controversial, racial justice, a woman's right to control her own body, economic justice, equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer folk, when we are in the news, inevitably, we get nastygrams. Voicemails and letters and comments that we're not a real church, not a real religion. Sometimes we think these folks just aren't educated about us. That's the Unitarian way, after all, to believe that most of the problems of the world would be solved if people were better educated. But some of them are quite well educated. And they make clear in no uncertain terms they think we're wrong, that we're misguided, that we've abandoned tradition in ways that are foolish and false, that our laxity about creed and doctrine is a sign of weakness, and that we're more interested in politics and coffee than we are in God and salvation. And I know what some of you are thinking. You are more interested in politics and coffee than God and salvation, and what's the problem with that? People come after me, too. I'm not a real pastor, they say, that somehow my credentials aren't real. My $40,000 in student loan debt begs to differ. I am real, and so are you, and this is a real religion. We try to brush it off when people say these things about us, but it stings when we're attacked. I deal with this professionally, but I know some of you deal with it at the family table, in the workplace, or when you visit your in-laws or your parents or your own children. They don't get it. They worry for the state of your soul. They say, "I'll pray for you to be converted," which feels gross, right? "Pray for me to live my best life or to be healthy or safe, but don't pray for me to convert to your faith." That's just insulting. And it's so tempting, isn't it, to get defensive, to attack the attacker. They're going to make fun of me, I'm going to make fun of them. It's tempting to cloak our hurt in superiority. Why are they mean to me? They're just jealous. That's what I do when I feel threatened. I retreat into ego. Anybody else do this? It's okay, put your hand up. And then usually I regret it later. That true for you too? Because a superiority complex might make us feel better for a moment, but it's gross too. Thinking that we're the best, it's human nature, but see how it feels from the other side. They say, "I pray that you'll convert to my faith." We might respond, "I hope you'll become as evolved in your thinking as I am." Are those statements really that different? Stephen Prothero critiques what is called the perennial philosophy, the belief that all religions are really the same, the sense that the rituals and practices and particularities of religion are unimportant, and that what religions share, an openness to wonder and an instruction to treat other people with respect, are the only important parts of faith. He critiques Houston Smith, who some of you may have read. Houston Smith has a metaphor that these rituals and practices and languages and art and culture, those are the foothills of religion, and the mountaintop is the ethical principle. And Prothero says the ethical principle is important, but so is all the rest. How much we miss, he writes, when we do that. How much we fail to understand when we don't go below the surface. When we don't see the way that each faith asks different questions, let alone provides different answers. How each faith has a history, stories, and depth and diversity within the tradition. And there's as much difference between a Pentecostal Christian and a Greek Orthodox Christian as there is between a Tibetan Buddhist and a Zen Buddhist, or between different schools within Islam or Judaism or Yoruba or Taoism. This perennial philosophy, which says that every religion is true, and he writes also the new atheism that says that every religion is false, both have the goal of minimizing difference. And given the history of those differences being used to justify and inspire horrible violence, wars, genocide, and oppression, one can understand the temptation. But neither approach is honest to the depth or character or diversity of faith. And neither approach is kind. Kind to the people whose lives are oriented by these faiths, who are comforted in grief, who are inspired to greatness, who are connected by them to something larger than themselves. And there's a real tension here for us, because the perennial philosophy is for us not just a strategy toward peace, but an actual article of faith. Indeed, it is our core belief that every religious tradition, and also science and art and, well, everything, offers up wisdom and beauty and truth, and that we, in community, using our conscience, put the pieces together in ways that inspire us to live with justice and love. That's our core belief, the heart of who we are, which means we are uniquely tempted to demonstrate interfaith egoism. We have an ability to be a bridge between faiths, but we can also demonstrate interfaith egoism. We're uniquely tempted to think that we have advanced beyond a childish faith to a more mature faith. Indeed, sometimes we use those very words. I've probably used them, and I shouldn't. Not really. But we are tempted. And it's especially tempting when we've been harmed or shunned or betrayed by another faith. When we were told we weren't orthodox enough, or submissive enough, or straight enough to be Christian or Jewish or whatever it might be. Some of us have been harmed by other religious traditions. We've been threatened, wounded, and in some cases even physically harmed or abused. Religion has been used as an excuse to justify that abuse and to continue it. And those wounds go especially deep because it is betrayal. To say love and do hate is treason. And so today I do not wish to diminish or wipe away the pain and harm that has been done to so many, including some of you, by faith and those who claim to be faithful. That's real. But here's a secret, or maybe not a secret, just something we don't talk about. This faith, Unitarian Universalism, this faith which I love, which I have given my life to, which some of you have devoted generations to, we too sometimes have done harm to others. We have too. When our words of justice are not matched by our practice, when people think our devotion to freedom means they are free to be horrible people, when ministers and others have abused their power and committed sexual or other misconduct, when we have promised a commitment to racial inclusion and justice right up until it meant giving up systems of white authority, we've done those things. We have our demons too, our mistakes. Some are more modest than that, but still harmful, when we mock others and their faith, when we talk about anyone who disagrees with us as inferior. A few summers ago, I visited a bunch of different congregations of a whole variety. It was part of my sabbatical to check out the competition. And at one Christian church in particular, I was shocked by the supersessionist language. Supersessionist means the way you talk about Christianity as being the fulfillment of Judaism, the higher evolution of the Jewish faith. Supersessionist thinking is an element of anti-Semitism, casting those Jews who don't follow Christ as backwards, as those who didn't keep up with the change. It was offensive for me to listen to. But later, reflecting on it, I thought, have we not sometimes done that? Used supersessionist language to talk about other faiths? Have we not thought they should have evolved with us? Look, I'm proud of our faith. We do some things really well, but not everything. And that's true of others too. They do some things really well, but not everything. Some other faith traditions, they go more in depth in their faith. They are working with one story and one set of metaphors, so it's easier to go more in depth. They have stronger commitments to particular spiritual practices, and they form rituals that can often hold people through their whole lives. Some of them practice pacifism or non-materialism in ways that are very profound. Some of them have commitments to ecology that are life-changing. Some of them have musical traditions that are ancient and beautiful. Some practice a level of generosity that is awe-inspiring. There have been times I've been tempted, I confess to you. Maybe I want the community that comes with being a Muslim. Maybe I want the sense of equanimity that comes with being a Taoist. Maybe I want the radical prophetic love that comes from following Jesus. Maybe I want the sensory ritual that comes with being a Hindu. But then I stop and I say, no, this is my home. I can't choose one of those because I want to explore them all. This father battle axe of moderation. I value moderation, blending and choosing and putting it together. I think there is a unity of all things, but that doesn't mean that I'm a better person than those who don't. That's just my path, and that means this is my home. To be a heretic is to choose. That's what heretic means, one who chooses. We choose. Even if we've been born into this faith, we choose to stay. This is our home. But others choose too. Even if they've been born into their faiths, so they choose to stay. And other homes are beautiful too. Sunlight and clover. And useful in their way to the people who follow them. Just because it doesn't work for you doesn't mean it doesn't work for them. If your faith makes you more decent, more compassionate, and more loving, then it is good. And any faith lived in certain ways can do that. And any faith lived in other ways can fail that test, ours included. We believe here that religion is a human endeavor. It is the struggle of human beings to make sense of the universe and our own lives. It is made and sustained and changed by human beings, religion is. That is our particular belief and one I am fully committed to. But think about it. If religion is a human endeavor, it is a lot like human beings, which is to say, unique and beautiful and imperfect. None of us see the whole story. No name is sufficient to name that which holds all, and we must therefore bring many names, and sometimes silence. Like human beings, religions have their own backstory, their own ways of being in the world, and you can't always tell by looking at the cover what's inside the book. So what is called for? Humility. Humility and curiosity. Learn before judging. Listen before appropriating. Love before deciding. How do we practice interfaith humility? The same way we practice humility in our life. Don't think our answers are better than other answers. Sometimes you can't even compare the answers because we're asking different questions. Don't mock or fear what you don't yet understand. Be kind. Be generous when ascribing motivation and intent. Ask questions. It's okay to make fun of yourself a little bit. It's good for you. But making fun of others, that can hurt. So be careful. Many religions do share an ethical teaching. You heard different versions of it in the anthem. Treat others as you wish to be treated. We call it the golden rule. Some go a level down, if you will, to a silver rule. Don't treat others how you don't want to be treated. And that would be a substantial improvement in our world. I would take it. But I'd like us to reach for a higher rule. Some people call this the platinum rule, if that helps you remember. Treat others the way they want to be treated. Not the way you want to be treated, the way they want to be treated, which means asking, how do you want to be treated? And sharing how you want to be treated. A back and forth. Humility is a prerequisite for genuine conversation and for the common work for a better world. At our worst, our arrogance shuts that down. But at our best, our commitment to discovery is the interfaith bridge that makes that possible. So let's try and be at our best, okay? We'll share a cup of tea or a beer or a walk in the woods and say, tell me what you love, what makes your heart sing, and I'll tell you what I love and what I care about, and we'll listen. And love what is different and what is similar in our stories, and neither of us will pray or hope for the other to change their mind, but we might hope and pray that together we might change the world. That's what's most beautiful. When nobody has the only answer, when everyone respects the choice that each of us might make, and then together we can try to live together, to learn together, to share together, to work together for a better world, to love together, and even sometimes to sing together. Let us rise in body or spirit. This is my song. I've extinguished our chalice, but not the light of truth or the warmth of community or the fire of commitment. These we carry with us until we are together again. And I invite you, if you haven't already, if you wish to join hands or stand near one another for our blessings and benedictions. The Reverend Sarah Morris Campbell wrote, "We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown." We'll sing together our closing blessing. We'll sing it through twice.